UWA-517, do you want to report a UFO?
Negative. We don't want to report.
Ares 31, do you wish to report a UFO? Over.
Negative. We won't report one of those either.
Ares 31, do you wish to file a report of any kind? Over.
I wouldn't know what kind of report to file, sir.
Ares 31, me neither.
There 71 Papa Golf, go ahead.
And was there anybody above us that passed us like 30 seconds ago?
There 71 Papa Golf, negative.
Okay. Stop this. It's a UFO.
Yeah. Hey, it's American 1095. Yeah, something just passed over. Don't know what it was, but it's at least 2,000-3,000 feet above us. Yeah, it passed right over the top of us.
911.
You guys busy? Do we just call about the UFOs we saw?
Mm-hmm.
They're out there, taking airplanes.
Howdy, dispatch.
Okay.
Bob, I swear to God, four calls in on an unidentified object over Liberty.
Four calls?
Four calls on an unidentified flying object.
All right, take a look. All right, we'll check it out.
Welcome to UFO Chronicles, a place where people share their experiences of the strange and unexplained. If you've had an encounter and would like to be on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com.
Hello and welcome to the show, everyone. I hope you're all doing good. Tonight's guest is Neb Borkovich, and he is going to be sharing his extraordinary encounters with UFOs while sailing across the Pacific Ocean in a 29-foot sailboat with his sailing companion, Don, in the year 2000. But before we hear from Neb, I want to give a shout-out to Wayne Martin and his future son-in-law, James, down on the Dorset coast. Thank you for listening, guys, and taking the time out to email me. I like getting emails from you guys, and it makes it all worth it. But remember, without you wonderful listeners, this show wouldn't be possible. And a lot of people think it's a whole team that works on this show, but it is just me. And I also want to give a big thank you to DBagwell30, MoneyGuy925 from the USA, and Gypsy Dream from Ireland, for leaving fantastic 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. It is something that really helps the show to gain more listeners, and more listeners means more guests. If you enjoy the show and you would like to help support the podcast on Patreon, you can do this for as little as $1 a month. Head on over to www.patreon.com/UFO Chronicles Podcast. You can also find a link in the description of this episode below. Any help is very much appreciated. Now, on with the show. I'm really happy to welcome Neb Borkovich to the show.
Good evening, Nick. Thank you very much for inviting me to your show.
It is great to have you with us today. Neb, would you like to start with a little bit about yourself and then what you experienced, please, sir?
I was born in former Yugoslavia, Belgrade, Serbia. And as a child, I immigrated to the United States in 1973. Prior to this, I lived in Croatia, an old city called Zadar, Zara. And since 1965 to 1973, there, I fell in love with the ocean and boating, particularly. My father had a little motorboat, and we took it out motoring to beautiful Adriatic islands in the region. There's some strange names here. Most people outside of former Yugoslavia probably wouldn't even know about them. Iš, Dugi Otok, and so on. So my father immigrated to the United States in 1972, and then I followed with the rest of my family and moved to Detroit 2 years, Buffalo, New York, where I finished my schooling in graphic arts. And then I moved to Phoenix, Arizona in 1981. So after all my schooling, all the youthful events in my life, I always had this desire for the ocean, to to explore, you know, to become a sailor. I read lots of adventure books from people who had been all over the world, sailed to Antarctica, to Polynesia. So it is something, it was almost like a siren's call. You have to do it. So for a while, I went to California. I lived in Los Angeles back and forth. And, since Phoenix is very close to San Diego and Pacific Coast, I also went to San Diego. And I just couldn't get enough of the boating scene there, looking at the boats and being jealous at people sailing. And finally, I saved up a little money and I bought a little sloop, Canadian made sloop called Voyo, which I named after my father. And after some, about a year or so of practice, a strange idea came to my mind to take it out into the distant ocean, maybe towards Hawaii. Now, I was advised by the older sailors that I met and talked to not to do it. It is too much of an adventure, too much for a first-timer. Go to Mexico, go someplace else. So I didn't know what to decide, but I thought about it, and I said, well, you know what? I'm going to do the Hawaii thing. Luckily, I had a person with me, so we went out 3 days out into the Pacific, and I got thoroughly scared. And we turned back. Within a week or so, the guy left, and I could not find anybody else to accompany me. So at the same time, the hurricane season was advancing, and my supplies were dwindling aboard a boat. So I decided, let's go swallow the bitter pill and let's do it. So I took off. It was back in 1991, alone, on a long voyage that lasted 52 days towards the Hawaiian island with only a small plastic sextant. At this time, the GPS just came out, but it was too expensive for me and too complicated. So I just spent this little sextant and radio direction finder, and I missed the island that I wanted to go to. I wanted to go to Maui, but I arrived to Big Island, the southernmost island of the group, after 52 days, and I promptly crashed into the rocks. I was rescued by U.S. Marines and aboard of a Sea Knight helicopter, and the rest is history. Of course, this kind of misfortune didn't teach me, so back in 1998, I bought my last boat, the third boat named Mira, which I named after my mother. Just a year or so prior to this purchase, I met this real fine guy, Navajo Indian fellow. His name is Donald Begay from Lukachkai, Arizona, Four Corners area near Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado, Four Corners. So he accompanied me. We trained for about a year. We went down to a 47-day-long cruise to Baja California, town of a tourist mecca, Cabo San Lucas, and then we ended up in a capital, Baja, which is called La Paz. Very beautiful desert area in the ocean, kind of like being in Utah. In Utah on the Mediterranean, red, colorful, fantastic place. So since the winter was already upon us and Christmas season, Don wanted to go home and he left. In about 10 days, I secured a boat and I took a direct flight to Phoenix from La Paz. It goes across the Sea of Cortez to a place called Guaymas, and from Guaymas connects to Phoenix. So within a couple of months, we returned back to the boat, and after some repairs, some preparations, and purchasing the supplies and food, and boat was in good shape. So we decided to go to Hawaii again. So we left La Paz on April the 8th with the idea of anchoring in the harbor of Cabo San Lucas before going out into the Pacific. This is a very much longer voyage, even from San Diego, a little over 3,000 nautical miles away. So you have to think twice before you do it, but I already thought about it. A decision was made. So how does this UFO adventure start? On the night of April 9th, we were slowly sailing. There wasn't too much wind, and slowly sailing just south of the Isla Ceralvo, a little uninhabited island, only a few fishermen live there. Let's say maybe 60, 70 miles south of La Paz. Still on our way to Cabo San Lucas. About 2 in the morning, I was outside steering the boat, kind of dozing off, and Donald was asleep below. And I started, I looked upward, and inside of this little cloud, I noticed these blinks. It kept going off and on, stopped, then again. Within several seconds, it started up again. And it was something that never left the cloud. I kept thinking that maybe this is an airplane going to Mazatlan from La Paz Airport. Never exited the cloud. There was no other lighting or rain or wind or nothing special. So I more or less disregarded it. The very next morning, right after breakfast, I forgot the time. I have everything written down in my notes. Again, I was staring. Donald was below, just washing dishes. I looked up and I see the sphere standing over us, high up, metallic sphere. Before I could even rub my eyes, it wasn't there anymore. I called Don to come out, and he didn't see anything. He just looked at me strangely, and he suggested we start the engine, which we did. Within a day or so, we were in the vicinity of Cabo San Lucas, and we were hit by a very bad gale, 40 to 50 knot winds, very high seas, and it was a pretty scary night, especially after being anchored for so long, you know. It takes a week or so to get to your sea senses again, to get your sea legs. And but we continued on. We didn't stop at Cabo San Lucas, which was an initial intent, but continued on. I didn't want to waste my supplies and just hang out at the anchor. The first night out, late in the morning, again, he was sleeping, and I noticed this green neon light falling from high in the sky and slowing down, and then it started hopping around like a little frog, a little, zip, 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 and it went behind some cloud, and it was gone. I was kind of weird. I never seen anything like that. It's the second or third time that we've seen something like this already. Another sighting was also in the same area, south of Sarawo. On the same afternoon from the first sighting of the chrome sphere, there was something elongated that came from the mountains, red orange color, and it showed itself up on a shoreline and went back into the mountains in a very strange, jerky, zippy motion. There's nothing there, absolute desert. Nothing going on there in that area. So this is the third time I've seen this green neon light, and but this time I was very puzzled. What's going on here, you know? Again, the following night, this time we both of us seen this, and this is the occasion which really absolutely blew my mind and totally put any kind of notions of there not being UFOs and they don't exist. This is fantasy, was completely swept away. Again, the same neon type of green light showed up falling, and it started circling high up above us. It would stop and blink, 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 disappear, blink on the other part of the sky. And there was just, it made a much, much larger blink. It made a 360-degree loop, disappeared into the outer space, leaving a long yellow trail behind it. I think I heard a pop. We both of us just looked at each other and said, this is not a man-made, this is not a satellite, there's nothing here. We actually haven't even seen a single airplane going there. Absolutely nothing. This was absolutely a mind-blowing experience. So we continued on. The next night, again, the blinker returns, only time this was red. This time it was red color, ruby red with some orange in the middle, and started descending in a falling leaf motion. Stood to our port side, maybe a half a mile away. Very bright red color, and this time we were kind of scared. You know, this is a third or fourth time we're seeing this, and this is not usual. This is not something normal. What does this mean? Why is this happening to us? I was petrified, and next thing I thought of, after looking at it through binoculars, I'm going to try to call this thing. So I got on my little VHF radio, which we had aboard, only about the 30-mile transmissal radius. And I got on the radio and called it. Hello, hello, hello. This is Sailing Vessel Mira. Who are you? please identify yourself. What would you like to know? Of course, I didn't receive any reply. The thing started climbing up, and it disappeared behind some clouds. So after this time, I decided this has to be recorded. I must put this down on a paper, the GPS positions, the time where it happened, the drawings, try to describe as best as I could, and possibly try to record it by video. The only piece of photographic equipment we had aboard was an old RCA camcorder, the type that you actually put the tape inside and slap it and hopefully catch something. It was a very unwieldy type of a camera, especially at night, because he had a light, internal light, which blinded me in my right eye, and my left eye, I have to close it. So many times I would lose the object in later on recordings. Plus the boat was moving, big waves and back and forth and yawning and pitching. And it was very hard to capture anything of substance. But actually I did a few times. So we had a couple of more sightings like that, mostly blinking lights in the distance until we reached the Big Island 35 days later, which happened on May the 12th. We pulled into the harbor of Hilo, on the southernmost island, the Big Island again, the same island I had the misfortune some years ago, and dropped the hook. Took a couple of days to get our land legs back and eat something good and shower up and look like humans again. And my next idea regarding the UFO sightings, I had to inform somebody, see if there's anybody on the island who would even listen, any reporter, any kind of UFO organization, MUFON or anybody else. I went into the phone booth, looked at the yellow pages, and there's nothing I can find there. There were a couple of palm readers and some gypsy people. nothing specific. So the next idea was try to go to the police station and see what maybe then have somebody, or maybe they want to take the report down or inform some other organization, whatever, whoever. I walked to the police station and they came out and said, what could we help you with? I said, well, I want to report the UFO. Some UFO sightings we had during our voyage. And they looked at me funny and they almost laughed. They smirked and said, well, we really can't help you. We never take this kind of reports. We never heard anything like that. Maybe you should try the Coast Guard. I said, yeah, that's a good idea. So that same day I walked to the Coast Guard station, and the clerk on duty informed me that the person I needed to talk to was Captain Kevin Lopes. But unfortunately, the ship he was on, the Coast Guard cutter named Kiska, wasn't in harbor. It would be back within 5 to 6 days. So I have to wait. So I agreed, no problem. We'll be here for at least a couple of weeks in Hilo Radio Bay. So we hung around, enjoyed the sights, and I took a bus around the island. Don stayed on the boat, enjoying himself, finally away from me for a while. And Kiska eventually returned. The next day, I went to talk to the clerks again. Said, yeah, Captain is aboard. You can go. You can proceed. Come and see him. So they were kind of waiting for me already. And I went there, talked to the man and another officer whose name I can't remember right now. I didn't jot it down. And I showed him the videos, whatever little I had. I showed him these notes that I kept, a number of pages, good 15 pages that I recorded from the inbound voyage. So he looked at me very interested. There was no smirking, no laughing. It was a very serious matter to him. What he did, he made a report about my sightings, took my boat's information, very official, and sent it to the Coast Guard group in Honolulu. Faxed it. That's all he could do, and referred me to FAA. You know, maybe they know something, they heard something. I didn't proceed with that legal investigation. But anyway, I thanked him and I left. And within a few days, we left Hilo on a month and a half long stay in the islands themselves. It was very beautiful. We hung out there for, like I said, over a month and a half, maybe. We went to Island of Maui. Anchored there for a couple of weeks, a place called Lahaina. Then we went around Molokai to the Oahu, island Oahu. Stayed there for a week, but the situation, anchoring situation, and was very, very unwelcoming. So were the port authorities. As a newcomer, you can only stay for a month, and you can't anchor here, you can't anchor there. Too much red tape. So at that time, I decided, you know what, instead of going to New Zealand, Polynesia, which I envisioned, or staying on the islands to find work, I decided to go back to San Francisco. So it was a big sigh of relief, at least the decision was made. So in this case, we went back to Maui, stayed there for another couple of weeks, stopping by the island of Lanai. Then we went back to around Oahu. This time we didn't even stop. We just sailed by to the island of Kauai, a tropical paradise, absolutely beautiful place. Rainbows, waterfalls, birds of paradise, lots of friendly people, artists, people camping on beaches, bohemians, other sailors. So it was a wonderful 2 weeks that we stayed there. And then in June, it was time to go. So I don't recall the date right now, but that's when we left. We left over San Francisco. This was to be a 42-day-long trip, and it is a much more demanding trip than coming to Hawaii from Mexico or California, because there you just go along with the trade winds. It takes about 8 days or so to reach the trade winds. You can tell by the way the boat's turning and the way the clouds look very, very puffy, like a huge atomic bomb explosions on the horizon. But to return to San Francisco or to Washington State or further north to Vancouver, this requires approximately 1,100-mile climb directly north to reach the Japanese current, Kuroshio, a North Pacific current which takes you towards California. And also by doing this, you avoid the area of calms, known as North Pacific Patch. Lots of garbage right now floats through there, all kinds of floats, some horrible. But this is a huge area which moves. In the summertime, it moves north, and there's no wind. It's just, you know, if you get stuck there, you could be there for a couple extra weeks without a good engine. So at a certain point, you need to have your engine on all the time just to traverse this 600 to 700 miles of calms. But anyway, to continue on, the first night out, we left early in the morning. The first night out, the UFO is back. It was almost as if they were waiting for us. We seen these two little lights that would come from different directions, little yellow lights. Sometimes they would stop by each other and start circling each other, then divide again and go back from where they came from. Sometimes there was a single object. And by this time, I was just exasperated. You know, what's going on? It seems like we're actually being followed. This is how I call and title my book later, Followed, because we actually were followed. Why would we be followed? Well, if you're following an airplane, you can stay with it for a while, or a car. If you're following a slow-moving boat and you want to keep an eye on it, it will take time. So you show yourself periodically. It's exactly why this happened. This was some kind of an experiment, so some kind of adaptation experiment, I think.
We'll be back with Neb after the commercials. To take us there, we have a song by one of our listeners, Yancey Yates, and it's called Purple Wren.
Across your killing blow, a drunken shaman points the way to a crystal palace glassy haze, choking on quartzite dust, beyond long nightmare, dead man's trust. We'll be right back. crooked tongue squeezes my elbow and sucks my thumb. Dancing on the greasy red oak boards, through my chest pops a sugary blind boy's soul. Humming, buzzing, pale green light, the master riches for under the bite. Turn to the coda, do it all again. The only truth you'll ever hear is from a purple rim.
Paranormal Talk Radio, you'll love the new Paranormal Radio app from TalkStream Live. You'll find a great selection of talk shows covering UFOs, ghosts, strange phenomena, and much more. Download the Paranormal Radio app now and start listening to the very best in paranormal talk entertainment, including the network you're listening to right now, the Paranormal Radio app, free in Google Play and the iOS App Store.
So, but by this time, I became a little more proficient with the camera, and I was able to capture some footage here and there. On one particular night, we seen an object high in the sky, cruising by, and this time I did something different. I grabbed my searchlight, half a million candle searchlight, and I pointed directly towards the UFO, towards the object. It stopped. And it sped away immediately with enormous speed, almost as if it was startled by my light. About half an hour later, the object is returning, stopped high overhead, and it just exploded into a large circle of light. And this kept going for a number of seconds, almost half a minute, which gave me enough time to dive below and grab my camera. I was able to capture this footage. And this one happened on July 14th, this particular footage. On July the 12th, 2 days prior to this recording, this is where the major event happened. Both of us are standing outside steering the boat. Our engine was on. We were passing through this parts of this calm area, so therefore the engine had to stay on. We noticed a light cruising high above, only this time it didn't go. It just started descending directly towards us. And we were looking at each other again. What is this? What is this now? And sure enough, it was coming down very intelligently, almost like a plane, but coming down from its high point. And it was something horseshoe-shaped. It had a number of red lights at the front of the object and a large squarish area on its stomach. Looked like a perfect horseshoe flying in reverse. It flew over us silently. For the most part, I think I could hear some kind of buzzing, but it was very, very fuzzy because my engine was on. But something was going on. It wasn't very loud. As it flew over us, it had a huge rectangular light in the back of its hull, something I never seen before. Yeah, I would say that the point was maybe, the height was maybe, 2,000 feet above us. It was followed by a similar looking object, but with less lights, different lighting distribution, but again, this huge squarish light in the back. They buzzed us 6 times altogether, 3 flights for each object, that's 6 overflights. It was absolutely mesmerizing. And this is the object I painted on the cover of my book, Followed, which people can see later on. But what was fascinating about this particular sighting is that the video I captured, when it was analyzed, stopped frame and blown up, it shows a almost identical looking object that we have in a book that we've seen two days prior. And it would be impossible. It would be impossible. I did not have a bank of computers aboard to manufacture this or fake it in any possible way. Actually, you cannot even see it until you stop the frames. You just see a large light lighting up. So they were there. Must have been the same type of object. When it blew up 2 days later, it was probably much higher up. Another very particular video segment that I think you have, Nick, is I was able to capture a maneuver when the object came, stopped, and instantaneously blinked out, disappeared. I was able to capture this on 3 different occasions, but only once it was in perfect focus, as described by MUFON's Jeffrey Sanyo, video investigator who has worked on my videos upon returning to Arizona after all these events. So yes, we've seen the object several more times, or objects sometimes. Sometimes, like I said, there were 2 flying in unison in high distance, blinking out. A few times I was able to exchange my light signals with it, blinking 4 times back and forth. And they answered. It was absolutely, I felt almost like being on some other planet, like some kind of very, very psychedelic experience, a very mind-blowing experience to have an object of unknown origin blinking lights back at you. So some kind of rudimentary, primitive type of communication was established there. Now, on late night and early morning between July 26th and July 27th in the morning, yes, this was where a very anomalous event happened, and which was to be a pivotal point on my entire investigation of this case later on, and which opened many new doors and new vistas for me later on. My friend Donald, he's a very simple type of man. He doesn't read very much. He only has a rudimentary education, maybe 8 grades of school. Never went to college, and I've never seen him reading a book, actually. This will become important later, this particular aspect of it. He was sailing the boat. I was asleep. Around 5 in the morning, I woke up and made some coffee, and it was my time to take over because we kept having these little shifts, maybe 4 to 6, 7, 8 hours of steering. I noticed he had a very bloodshot red eyes, and he was complaining of a headache in 2 spots. And I told them, well, just go below, get some sleep, take an aspirin, you know, take a Tylenol, you'll feel better. You know, I'll try to steer as long as I can. So sure enough, he went to sleep. Around 11:30, he wakes up, looks around, drinks some coffee, and informs me that he had a very strange dream. At this time, we were only about a week away from making landfall back into California. And I told him, well, that sounds interesting. Why is it strange? What did you dream? He said, well, I dreamt that I was back home in Lukachikaya, my little town in northern Arizona. And in my dream, I was standing outside of my hogan, which is a traditional Navajo home, it's very circular, made out of eight sides, and the door always points to the east. And there are some other structures around there. In his dream, he said that he was standing outside with his brother. They were both looking skyward, and they noticed this huge object full of lights, crown-shaped, full of lights, kind of like a neon displayed advertisement sign flying over their town, very close to their hogan. Blinking lights, they said they were changing, almost like light bulbs going off and on. And I said, wow, this is strange. You know, would you please be able to put this down on a paper, make some kind of drawing before you forget it? You know, I've already compiled a large dossier of sightings in my logbook here. So why not add this, since we know we're being followed by these things? So, yeah, he agreed, just sat down and smiled and took a pen, and he drew this very enigmatic drawing. It was circular on the bottom and crownish in its profile. There's some dots and some partitions, and some of them curved. There was a middle divider. I said, this is very strange. You know, how would he come up with something like this? It's almost like a design of some kind. Something from a dream. So this is very weird. Then this kind of vaguely reminded me of a strange dream experience that I've had prior to meeting him in 1997. Now, we all know that 1997, I lived in Phoenix, Arizona back then. There was a major UFO sighting known as Phoenix Lights, enormous triangular boomerang type objects that flew over town. I've never seen those, that particular event. But I recall that I was asleep in my room. It was totally pitch black. I lived alone in the little one-bedroom apartment. Pitch black. And I'm dreaming. I'm dreaming of a sky that exploded with UFOs. There were balls, there were saucers, there were rockets flying by. All of a sudden, they're all moving apart, moving away. And it comes this like a mothership type of object that came on the scene, which to me also looked kind of crownish. I couldn't see much detail on it. And this was such a beautiful dream. And I'm waking up from the dream. As I'm waking up, I cannot move. I have a sleep paralysis. I cannot move, but my eyes are opening and I'm realizing I'm in my bedroom. But somebody is standing in a doorway at the foot of my bed, in the doorway to the living room, to the kitchen area also. And I can't move, but my eyes are open. I'm saying, who is this? Who's there? Who's looking at me? Next thing I know, I see this dark torso, one arm that lifted up, and this ghost-like figure just flew right through the ceiling, disappeared. So this, in a way, his drawing activated my memories of this dream that I had prior to meeting him in 1997. So I felt this is very strange. I was very, very happy, very glad that he was able to put this in a paper. So it's I think you have a picture there you can display for people, and it's also displayed in my book and many other places. On some video shows I've done, people can see what it looks like. But anyway, about 7 days after these events, after this dream event, we have made a landfall, San Francisco. It was a cloudy late summer day, which always is in San Francisco. It has some of the coldest summers in the country. We went underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, and we anchored in the area of the Marin County, north of the city itself, which is called Richardson Bay. We dropped the hook there, and we had to recuperate for a couple of weeks to see and decide what we're going to do with the boat. Are we going to stay there, go back to San Diego, or what? So the decision was made to leave the boat in storage and after a while go back to Arizona, where we both lived, because we had to work. You know, we've been sailing and enjoying ourselves for too long. So before actually leaving San Francisco, I decided to do something about the sightings, since the Coast Guard already took an interest in it, and I wanted to find out any kind of a UFO type organization or a reporter who would be willing to listen to my story. I made numerous calls and I was turned away, disregarded, laughed off, until I found one newspaper which was interested in the story, Marin Independent Journal. I was told to come down for the interview within a couple of days and get introduced to a lady named Jane Futcher, who listened to our story and promised to make an article about it sometimes later. She also introduced me to ufologist Peter Davenport, to whom I made a report, talked to him, sending my materials, and he advised me what to do. But once I returned to Arizona, who to contact, told me to contact MUFON, and gave me a name for a gentleman named Tom King, who has actually recorded some of the Phoenix Lights in 1997 during the original events, who was becoming sort of an expert in videography. So I was very thankful to Davenport, and we secured our boat, thanked Mrs. Futcher about a possible future article, and we left back to Arizona. Back in Arizona, within a few days, I called MUFON, and they sent out a team. Three-member team led by a gentleman named Jim Kelly. He brought along Judy Warnes, who was later to become a state director of MUFON, and a man named Jason Ingraham. Kelly listened to our story together, and then he separated us. Ingraham stayed with me, and Judy Warnes talked to Don to take his account of events. We filled out the official MUFON report form. We gave them the copy of the videos, which I already prepared. And they left. They thanked us and they left and said they'll be in touch to call back if there's any other strange dreams or intuition events or recalls or anything else that we could fill in. So we thanked them and they left. Within a few days, Don left Phoenix. I stayed in Phoenix, but that's where I lived. He went back home to Lukachukai to see his family. It's been a long time. So we were apart for a while. And then on September 22nd, he calls me. And he said, guess what, Neb? I said, what? What happened now? What's happening? Well, I've seen the UFO with my family in broad daylight, came over our town, and I took a picture of it. I said, no, you're pulling my leg. This is not serious. Are you sure? I said, yes. It was there in broad daylight about 2 p.m., standing over town towards some mountains in the background, Chuska Mountains, they're called. And I was able to capture a couple of shots of it with my little camera, little throwaway Kodak camera. It stayed there for 40 minutes altogether. Me and my niece, we looked at it through binoculars. So this is fantastic. How could this be? Would you please send me those photographs? He agreed. Within a few days, they were in the mail, and I took them along with the ocean videos to Tom King, who sat down and he promised me a report. He looked at all the materials, and the only thing on a photo was this little whitish spot. And he said not to worry. He can enlarge it to see what it looks like. And he ruled out any kind of an airplane, any kind of a balloon. Any kind of, obviously couldn't be a satellite or a bird. There are no helicopters there. Only thing that ever flies there are jetliners. They leave a long, nice jet trail behind them at night or daytime. And nothing else, not even a helicopter. no sightseeing flights. There were no toy or a personal drones like we have today. Back in 2000, maybe only military had some large ones to use in war operations. So there were no drones. There were no toy balloons. All the hot air balloons there in Albuquerque, people, you know, taking them for trips. Nothing in this desolate area. So there were no wings. Once he enlarged the object, he showed something acorn-shaped, and there was no indication of any wings, so it was anomalous. In the meantime, I continued on with other aspects of the investigation. Through MUFON, I met this very great lady. Her name was Ruth McKinley Hover, who was a very well-established member of UFO community in Arizona. And she was a professional psychiatrist, very well known and connected with Professor John Mack's peer organization. He kept in contact with a number of psychiatrists or psychologists interested in the field, in the abduction field, and she was one of them. They kept their own little groups, and she would forward this information, whatever she could gather from hypnosis or other events, straight to John Mack. So this was very well established. I met her through MUFON, and I became more or less a fixture in all the meetings, international meetings in Laughlin, Nevada, in San Francisco. We met there because my boat was still there. I got to meet Stephen Friedman. I met Bud Hopkins, Jim Mars, Travis Walton, all through her. Very interesting. But not to jump too far ahead, I decided to have a hypnosis session with her to see if there's anything else that could have happened during this voyage. And it was fascinating. First of all, I didn't think I was going to be able to get hypnotized, but I was. It was very good. After a while, I kept losing her voice. She tried to keep me calm, said to relax. And, you know, you guys are slowly sailing, and you're seeing this light in the sky. And very soon, I'm losing her voice. And I find myself outside of a boat floating, just my body. I could see the dark ocean below us and nothing else. I couldn't find a boat. There was no dawn, nobody, just myself. What am I doing in the sky? Next thing I know, I see this little saucer sticking over a cloud, outside of a cloud with some yellow lights below. And I was wondering, why is this saucer here in a cloud? Next thing I know, I'm in some kind of a little enclosed space, like a little car or something beige color. And I could see a wall of green light to my right. And I felt some kind of a commotion around me. And this made me lose my cool. I almost had a heart attack during this session. I couldn't bear to be there anymore. And I was very excited. My heart was pounding. I couldn't breathe very well. And luckily, she brought me out of the scene. And she said, your mind did not want to go there. But during this time, as I was going through this with her, I sent out my ocean videos to Jeffrey Sanio. And a month later, after this hypnosis session, he brings me the results, mails me the results. One or two that he found anomalous is the big light, which shows the craft. And the other one where the craft disappeared. And he said in his own report, all of this is laid out in my book. I have a written report. He said that nothing could disappear this fast. It just blinks out. One frame is here, the next frame is gone. So he said even airplane lights would take quite a while to extinguish. This thing was gone in one frame. So then I was really mesmerized by all this, and I decided to explore further. Now, where could this thing go? Sanio really didn't want to get too much deeper into it. So he only sent me what he could see. Very conservative type of investigator. So I took this video segment to a studio in Phoenix. You know, they don't deal with UFOs, but they could do whatever you ask them to. You know, the professionals, they have all kinds of computerized equipment and enhancers and whatnot. And I told them, please, take a short video where this light stops, and blow it up, clean it up as much as you can, see what's in there. It cost me $300 out of my own pocket. I was so intrigued. I wanted to find out what this is. And sure enough, it crystallized into some kind of a flying saucer, obvious flying saucer craft, like two plates inverted. I think you have that, Nick. You can show it to people. The next frame is gone. They couldn't explain it, you know. And we all know the speed of video frame is 1/30th of a second. So I still wondered about that. And I had a good friend who was pretty handy with computers. And I asked him, let's work on this. Let's find out how this thing disappeared. Of course, the people in the studio, they couldn't tell me anything. Nobody could tell me anything. So we took the dark frame and we started enlarging. And maybe about 11 levels of zoom, we find this little tiny microscopic white spot, only 4 pixels. So this thing disappeared from being visible from point A to point B, 1/30th of a second. Now, speed of the video frame is the speed of light, electricity, 180,000 miles a second. So when you divide this into 30 parts, you get the speed of 6,200 miles. This thing took off from being visible to invisible at approximately 6,200 miles an hour, 1/30th of a second. And this happened a month after my hypnosis session, showing a saucer. And there were also reports from Hawaii, from Mexico and California before, during, and after our sightings of people seeing approximately the same things. Actually, I found a report through Davenport's Newfork Net. I found a report of man seeing a saucer type craft sticking out of a cloud over Hawaii, over Oahu, a few months after our sightings. So I don't know how much more verifications do you need. On a second subsequent session with Dr. Root, I was able to get hypnotized very well. But again, I couldn't get very far. I see this huge black eye staring at me, almost tranquilizing me. It seemed like he knew everything about me, like he cared about me. There was some kind of love there. And I could see a little bit of wrinkled skin, bluish, grayish skin on the side of his eye, which also had a yellow type membrane, orange-yellow membrane on the bottom of it. But he kept staring at me. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything. And I started getting very excited, very disturbed, and she had to bring me out of it. So she said, your brain just does not want to go through this door. So I don't think this hypnosis can really help you very much anymore. So we stopped. So for a number of years, my book came out, and I decided to write a book, Followed, which gave a complete assessment of the voyage itself and the events in the first part. The second part is an analysis, the best as I could, with the knowledge I had back then, knowledge that I heard from people, from experts, the shows I watched, the other witnesses. The best I could is written the book from 2002 at the level that I knew then. So, in the meantime, I was trying to promote the book. I went a couple of little speeches around Phoenix, a show in San Diego, and a couple of radio shows and things of that nature. And then in 2004, this is where I had a major breakthrough. And how this happened is absolutely phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. And this opened a new door for me to investigate this further and understand the entire phenomena from it. Don's drawing that he drew on July the 27th was to be the key. I was invited to speak at the college, Navajo Community College, at small town of Salie, maybe 12 miles south of Lukachikai, only college there. I spoke about my book, and I had a bunch of videos to show them, talk about UFOs. It was a very nice meeting. And I stayed in the area as a Don's guest for a few days. But the college also had a nice library of all kinds of Native American artifacts, books, paintings, drawings, museum-type exhibits. And I spent a lot of time browsing through there, several hours in those days that I stayed there. Not much really else one can do. And one book in particular caught my attention. I didn't even know what I was looking for. It's almost like being led towards certain books and certain materials. It was called The Warrior, Shield, and a Star by a professor of archaeology in New Mexico, Polly Shazma, that was her name. I think she's still alive, still active. A very elderly lady, maybe 80, 90 years old. It was a fantastic book. It showed some ancient shields in which one can obviously see entities sitting inside. And in the legends, these shields could travel through the air, cause rain, and they could take the owner flying very high, very fast throughout the sky. And most of these shields from her book actually don't even exist. They're just petroglyphs and pictograms. Some of them are displayed in Islota Pueblo in New Mexico. That's what she mostly got her materials from, and some others also. So fascinating book. And right next to her book, there was another book called Pueblo Shields. Maybe very, very slim little book. Everybody could just pass right by it. I opened it and started leafing through it. And on page 8, I believe, my jaw just drops. There was a drawing, illustration of an object, obvious shield, which almost exactly matches Don's drawing from his dream. I almost dropped the book. What does this mean? And I know Don had never seen this book or never talked about anything like this. He read the Bible a few times, but like I said, very, very simple man. And I didn't know what to do. So I started suspecting that the dots and lines may mean something, especially on a shield. It could also be a good defender. You know, if you're fighting somebody wearing that shield, they can confuse them for a second, then you can club them with an axe or deflect an arrow or a club or whatever, a war type of implement.
Telepath is a weekly digital newsletter filled with the latest paranormal news, trending topics, and fresh articles from some of the most popular critical thinkers in the community today. Stay informed on your favorite paranormal podcasts and live streaming talk shows. Interact with the Telepath and upload your paranormal story or pics. It could be featured in an upcoming edition. Sign up right now for the free Telepath newsletter at paranormal.radio. That's paranormal.radio.
Then I had to find out about shields. So how were these shields made? What are they? You know, I didn't know anything about this type of research. So I found out these were made out of buffalo hide. And each warrior had an individualized shield. It wasn't like being in a Christian army, Spanish army, Roman army. Here's your shield. Grab it. Go fight them. You know, they all look the same. Maybe the noblemen or big warriors have a different type of shield. But no, each shield was made specifically for a single warrior. While the painting was applied on a buffalo hide, it was done through a ritual. Only the medicine man, specially appointed medicine man, that knew certain chants, could do this painting for each individual warrior. So that was that aspect I had to learn about, actual historical aspects of making shields. Then a second thing, I started counting the dots and dash lines going through both the shield and Don's drawing. And the ancient shield had 142 dots in it. So back then, you know, it was 2004. We had internet, but it wasn't like today. You know, you couldn't jump all over the place. It took some real hard research. I put the number of 142 to see what I can get. You know, anything about 142. And first thing that comes up is this allusion to a biblical psalm, 142. Well, he was in the cave. You know, I'm not a religious man. I'm an atheist. You know, I never even read the Bible. But it talks about the soul that is trapped in a cave, is praying to Lord to release him, and one day he will be released and be among the righteous, that his enemies are stronger than him, that they sprung a trap for him, and he needs to get out of this cave. One day he will be recognized, which is a strange little Psalm 142 you can see in the Bible yourself. Then I started counting Dan's drawing, his dots and his dashes. The shield, original shield, five partitions, and Don's had five partitions on the bottom, on the top, and three partitions on the bottom. And altogether, 81 dots in a circle, and 32 dots in the profile. So altogether, 145, 81, 145. So I started learning more about the shields, trying to follow the story. Where did these shields come to this book? What is this entire story? And I find an article from newspaper in Utah from around that time that people are fighting over the shield. There were several tribes trying to claim the ownership of it. The Navajos, the Hopis, the Utes, and Apaches. Everybody wanted to possess, and some several other smaller tribes in New Mexico area, they all claimed the ownership to it. And this shield was found in 1927, I believe, or 26, by a man named Pechtold, Ephraim Pechtold, while he was walking around looking for minerals, I believe, with his family, with his daughter and his wife. They found his little crevice and dug in it and found three shields. And this particular shield was one of them. Very beautiful. And they were in his possessions for a long time until the federal government took them, displayed them at Granite Reef, I think it's called, the National Monument in Utah. And it was on display for a number of years while the court case was going on between these tribes fighting over the shields, all three of them. And it was finally awarded to the Navajo tribe in year 2005, almost like a biblical allusion. So then you have 1926 and Don's shield, Don's drawing, 36 dots atop, 26 dots in the middle, kind of drawn like a serpent through the middle, and 19 dots on the bottom. 1926 and 36, and he was 36 years old when he had this dream. On July 26th in Nidruit, on July 27th. July 26th is a Mayan New Year too. Amazing stuff. So then, about this time, my mind is totally blown up. I wanted to explore further. So 145, again, I put the number into the computer, and the first thing that comes up is an allusion to Ceres cycle, which is a cycle of solar eclipses. At least 42 Ceres that are constantly happening, and they can stretch for 1,500 years from the first partial eclipses, then it travels to the equatorial region, become full eclipse, and then later on it peters out to the north side of the globe, towards the North Pole. So there are 42 cycles constantly circling. So Ceres Hunger 45, the first eclipse of Ceres Hunger 45 happened in 1639, at the same time that Descartes lived and wrote Sir Bacon, who worked in cryptography. Also, from this particular shield, a little sample was taken in order to settle the court case. A small sample of buffalo hide was taken to UCLA in the 70s to try to date it. And a radiocarbon dating shows year of the buffalo's hide when it died, approximately 1640. So now you can see how this became some kind of a message, a cryptogram. So then I tried to to redraw his drawing because it was really kind of a, it wasn't exact. So I put it in much better presentation. It was very, very difficult to draw the circle. And I tried to match the edges, the nine edges to the drawing itself. Because when you put a bottom like it was in his dream that he saw, the bottom would not match the crown. It just wouldn't match. The central section to which the serpent is going would not meet the, if it did meet the lines of the side of the shield, it would be far smaller. It would be nothing like the drawing of the circle itself. So then I started viewing it, thinking about it in a different manner. I thought that maybe, let's assume that this is a UFO, something manufactured, something factory produced, wherever the factory was. at this time, see, I kept thinking of the entire phenomenon as being extraterrestrial. And a few years ago, I totally threw away this idea. This is something far bigger. But anyway, going back to the shield, I started viewing it in a manner that this is something manufactured. So if you have nine sides and 32 dots on one side, let's assume if this is an object, there must be another side to it. Imaginary side, an invisible side. So only when I did this and I stretched the crown around the inside circle, kind of like an accordion, opening an accordion, it perfectly fit. Everything fit. And this happened on November 11th, on exactly the day that Yasser Arafat died, 11-11 of 2004. So this was absolutely fantastic. This became later on an entire science. So the ancient shield activated Don's drawing as being some kind of a subliminal type of cryptogram. And I'm very well aware about the numerical aspects of it. And later on, at this point, I believe that I'm able to decipher maybe a good 75% of the entire phenomena with this knowledge. I found things that jibe old, ancient, historic UFO sightings as presented through every culture, ancient Egypt, and going farther back into the Paleolithic times. And with the modern sightings. So you have ancient stuff, you got the new stuff, but I found the meat, the connective tissue between the two, and it's through the mathematics and geometry. So one can, at this point, with big safety, you can discard the extraterrestrial hypothesis. And one of the very few people who has some strong arguments against it is also famous, one of the best explorers in the world, Jacques Vallée. Everybody knows Jacques Vallée. He's not an ET proponent. I read some of his work, and I totally agree with it. But even he only goes back to, he goes to Middle Ages. He will go back as far as Egypt, the first sighting of the pharaoh, about 1500 BC. But the pharaoh, they're describing the UFOs flying over them as circles of light. They had no clue what it is. At the same time, they're looking at their pyramids, which has some, which is connected to this phenomena in mathematical and geometric ways. And everything else before them is absolutely fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. And I'm still working on this today. And this will be the subject of my new book someday when I can sit down and write it, actually. Every aspect of this requires the utmost of our sciences, both physical, anthropology, physics, mathematics, biology, history, every aspect of it. And how is one man, one simple man like myself, able to put all this together without help? Nobody pays any attention. And this is my point today. This is where I'm at today. And I think I could conclude with this.
That is absolutely fascinating, Neb.
Well, This blew my mind, man. This is absolutely. I can give you, I can send you some info on it.
Please do. To the listeners, all information and the details and the drawings and the videos, everything Neb's got is below this episode in the description. I think Neb, because you spent time at sea
and you take note of everything in the logbook, storms, what you eat. This is why you have so much detail about what you saw and have experienced.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, after a couple of sightings, you have to do it because it, if you're a witness of a UFO someplace in a large city flying over people or in a bus or an airplane someplace, you may be interested in the airplane, okay? When you're alone in the ocean, it's looking at you. Only you and your friend. Your boat is coming to see you. You know? There's nothing unambiguous about it. And therefore, I had to sit down and start jotting these things down on the paper. And other people have seen it. You know, I tried to do as much as I could.
This is way more than just a chance meeting in the middle of the ocean. There is so much more to it.
Well, I believe, there's far more in Lukachukai. There's far more. I'm just discovering new things. You know, I'm not at liberty to talk about all these numbers, but it's numerical. It's also lines of positions. There are new discoveries that I've made in Lukachukai. So it is almost as if we were destined to meet, as if I was brought to Europe from Europe to America by my father to meet Don someday. And Don was an instrument. He was a kind of like an antenna that this knowledge came through. It also could do with a former life, because the reason why the shield was given back to the Navajo, there was only one old medicine man, Don or James, I forget his first name. His last name was Holiday. He was the only one that knew the ceremony of the shields. He could still sing that song, and he knew about it. He was a very well-respected medicine man, and he ascribes the ownership of the shield to an old warrior named Many Goat Whitehair, who was killed in skirmishes with the Spaniards back then in that time. I tried to find his name in his historical annals, and I still cannot find it. But this is the only reason the Navajo tribe got the shield back in 2005, after my discovery. And this is all written in the newspapers. I can send you the copies. I mean, it's just not something. There's a whole NAGPRA. It stands for a National Grave Appropriations Agencies that certain tribes or individuals can claim for their ancestry from the United States government. So this is absolutely mind-blowing stuff. And I believe the phenomena itself has been here since the very. I'm finding it to go back to the time of Australopithecines. It's very possible they've seen it, and Homo erectus, a Java man. The reason I'm finding this is through the black triangle phenomena that we're seeing right now, and I have seen in town of Y. I forgot to mention this sighting, in which I recorded in 2009 with a different friend, a huge boomerang and a large triangle-shaped craft that flew over us. And I got the video, and there's far more information here that I have that I'm not at liberty again to disclose yet. But it jibes, it connects everything with the earlier events. It also ties the sighting to other UFO events. I found the reason why they're coming. And it's very subtle and it's mathematical. You can chase UFOs for the next 50 years if you want. Take excellent shots, talk about propulsion. And that's the only thing most people here today are discussing is Roswell, what crashed, which general said what to what senator, who recorded this, who said that. The other guys are going to Alpha Centauri. They're talking to Syrians. They're talking to people from Andromeda. People. So it's absolutely mind-blowing stuff. How little we know. But my friends, I have found the connective tissue, or what this is. And I believe it's something that coexists with us in some kind of a no-time environment. There's lots of time disturbances involved with these sightings. For example, you have two similar cases with Travis Walton and Armando Valdez in Chile case. I don't know if you're familiar with the case, with the five soldiers in Atacama Desert. They were guarding their post there. And this was in 77, 76, I mean, about the same time, not too far from what Walton experienced. They have seen two objects high in the sky, which started landing. One of them landed high in the distant hills. The other one landed nearby the group. And they were all confused, looking at the object. And Armando decided to investigate it. He was a man in charge. He was only in his about 25 years old. The other soldiers held him back. Please don't go there. It could be dangerous. He said, no, I have to do it. And he walked right into the light and disappeared. He was gone for 15 minutes. He came out screaming like a madman. The object has left. In the meantime, saying something, he never felt like he was, he didn't know where he was. He never felt like he was actually abducted. But he said, they kept saying that he heard the words, "We know who you are, but you don't know anything about us, and we will be back," or something to that effect. But the problem was, even though he was gone for only 15 minutes, his watch, the time has stopped, but the date on his watch showed 5 days later, and he had a 5 days of beard growth. 5 days of beard growth, he was clean-shaven just 15 minutes earlier. And at one time, while Travis Walton was in Phoenix in one of his presentations, I asked him, "What happened with your clothes, pants, your shirt that you had on during the experience? Did you ever use the restroom? Did you soil your shorts, your pants?" He looked at me funny and said, "No, I gave it away to a ground saucer watch investigators." He turned them over, the clothes, to analyze. But he doesn't remember soiling his pants. Now, think about it. If somebody was gone for 5 days, you'd have to use a restroom, even if you were knocked out in coma. Either number one or number two. He doesn't recall it. So this testifies. He was also gone for 5 days. This 5 days seems to be a norm here. So that means that the time is flowing different on the ship than it's flowing here. How it's done, don't ask me. Maybe some physicists would have an answer. But this is coming from some kind of a dimension in which time, as we know, doesn't exist. It stopped. Therefore, the phenomena is always showing a same appearance, doing the same thing over and over and over again. It looks the same. And these triangles, my friends, this is nothing that was made up from United States Arsenal. It is nothing that came out in 1800s, as David Marler is talking about in his book. This is ancient. This has always been here. So we're dealing with something tumultuous. These are not space aliens.
They've probably been here longer than we have.
Yeah. Every our culture, every religion, mythology is talking about this, and there are actual connections, mathematical connections leading to this. Like I said, it's going to the earliest recordings, the one made from Trinil, Indonesia, Java man, Homo erectus. He made the little etchings in a shelf or something they've seen. In the jabs with other triangles later on that were shown in Africa, in a cave from Africa from 170,000 years ago. And later on, this transferred into the goddess worship throughout the world. You find the same numbers in the Pacific, in Russia, in South America. Viracocha is a reference to the triangle or V-shaped craft. That's what it is. It's not any kind of a white god coming over like on a boat with a beard trying to civilize savages after some kind of a calamity.
Have you started on your new book now?
No, I'm still gathering evidence. I got piles of it. See, it takes off in many different directions. You have to be proficient in anthropology. You have to be proficient in biology, in history, Egyptology, every possible. Mathematics, geometry, ufology. I mean, it's just an enormous job. I mean, I can just work on one leg. I may start with the shield thing, even in itself, the science. And people, you know, you got to be pulling on people's sleeves and nobody wants to talk. And it's very hard, very, very hard.
It's very much like a spider's web, isn't it? It's everything is just connected.
Well, yeah, because, you know, unless you show it in a proper way, people will not believe it. They're going to scoff at it. And the secrecy. I believe that there's somebody pulling the strings. If this came out and it was meted out to people in a very comprehensive way, this could have very negative effects on entire religious systems and on anthropology and history itself and our entire being. You know, never mind the military and safety measures that you're talking about through UAP and whatnot. That's a separate issue. You know, if you don't shoot at them, then I'm going to shoot back at you, you know. So at this point, I've even lost my interest in chasing UFOs, and I've heard enough stories. It's here. It's proven, you know. What more proof do you need? You know, scientists have seen this.
Yeah, we're not at that stage, are we, anymore? That are they or aren't they? They are. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
It is a thing. We have to move beyond this now.
But the problem is, if it's even they, you know, it could be it. It could be the consciousness itself, this environment in which diffuses. They could just take up the shape. Remember the Navajo allusion to the mother goddess of their calling would be a changing woman. Changing woman. They can change. And I think these apparitions, Marian apparitions, they're using these things to reinforce this system, something that Jacques Vallée calls a control system. They're shaping our destiny. They have convinced Constantine the Great to take Christianity. He had a dream, and they showed up in the shape of a cross. Entire army has seen it. This has been recorded. And this is not just my musings, but there are certain American values that I can compare to newer and older cases that testify to this. So Constantine the Great takes Christianity, and Christianity spreads to Europe. So they can affect our historical moves forward. And they're also here watching us because of the destruction of the planet that's going on. Look what's going on, the fires and everything else. And there's another danger, which is bigger. People don't even talk about it very much. Worked on it recently by several independent scientists and universities. It's not so much that the ocean levels that are rising due to melts in the ice fields in Antarctica and mountains and Greenland. That's dangerous, yes. But we could be extinct very soon, because as the ocean warms, the phytoplankton, which is the beginning of a food chain in the ocean and all over the planet, regular plankton, they eat phytoplankton and the other animals, single-cell animals, the others, and it's a whole food chain, collapse. And the forests, Amazon and elsewhere, are only about 40% responsible for resupply of the oxygen in our atmosphere. And that would collapse too, and they're already under attack themselves. Phytoplankton is already migrating north, and tropical fish is already found in the Mediterranean. And they're projecting within 100 years, but most likely less, we could lose our oxygen. We could drop dead. Of course, there could be some survival maybe in space stations, maybe in the moon, some kind of habitats but not for very long. This intelligence has been around us, and it's been warning people about this. So we're in great danger. And I believe that people, they already have captured people. All these people disappearing in forests. You can track these people disappearing for the last couple hundred years. Mysterious disappearances. A witness, abduction witness, Betty Andreasen, about whom Raymond Fowler has written 5 books, describes seeing people in some kind of a plastic or glass containers, people from all walks of life, from every race, from every age, children, women, Native Americans, blacks, whites, Chinese, all over the world, being preserved almost in their time within these containers, as these beings are taking her through wherever they are habitating at the moment. So they could be preserving us for repopulation or life elsewhere as samples. Same thing with animals. And this animal mutilation process has also been going on for thousands of years. It's nothing new. Why? Absolute mystery. Anybody who tells you that they know where they come from, what they are, it's absolute nonsense.
I agree. And it's the more you think about the possibilities, the more mind-blowing it is.
Yeah, but I have a heap of findings here. I just need to sit down and organize it. It's very hard. You're dealing with corona, dealing with dealing with joblessness, dealing with health, dealing with people who are irresponsive. It's very hard.
Yeah, it's very difficult. Very difficult times, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think there's some kind of a hand here is pulling a wool over it, trying to prevent from all this knowledge to come out. That's why the secrecy is very deeply ingrained and very, very deeply installed in our communities and our society today. So you can talk about talk about little green men, about aliens, invasions. That's fun. That's, you know, and majority, 90, 95, 97% of people have no clue what this is, or even have an idea, even the witnesses.
There is a bigger picture to all this.
Yes, yes. And I believe it has to do with birth and death. I think they know us, each one of us. This is why there are so many abductions, so many experiences, so many manifestations. It's all over the place. They know each and one of us from the life before, from this dimension of no time, from which I believe our physical world springs into existence and is being maintained. This is something beyond our ken, almost godlike powers. How would you say it? This can prearrange your entire life. This can prearrange geography, mountains, locations. I found GPS positions that correspond with this, and shapes and numerical values. The UFO comes is not just leaving traces of people have seen this event, went this direction, went that direction. It has to do with position, where it's coming to, elevations, number of population. UFO is taking all of this into measure, into consideration, why it's there. And you, it's coming for you to tell you something. Absolutely fantastic. I think before I...
You just got to be able to listen and understand.
Or if I showed you this stuff, it would make sense. It's kind of hard to just blurt it out here.
That's amazing. And you definitely have to come on again as soon as you get this next book sorted. So, you know, you're always more than welcome to come back.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for having me. And it is people like you and a few others that keep this alive. This is, I think, the most important issue we're facing today.
I agree. And it's important that this information gets freely flowed, you know, to as many people as possible. That's great, Neb. Absolutely fascinating. Great talking to you.
Thank you, Nick. Appreciate your help.
All right. You take care.
Thank you. Good night.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
That is it for today. All information relating to Neb's experiences and links to his book followed can be found on the podcast website, ufochroniclespodcast.com. Just follow the link below this episode in the description. And if you or someone you know has had an encounter and would like to share it on the show, you can email me at ufochronicles@gmail.com and keep updated with the podcast on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. And a big thank you to our guest tonight, Neb, for sharing his encounters. And thank you for listening. I will be back next week. Till then, stay safe and keep watching the skies. Goodbye.